Father in heaven, we thank you that you are the great physician, the great counselor as well, that you want to guide us to healthier lifestyles. Please help us this afternoon as we continue on that journey. We ask it all in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, I know I was probably advertising this session too hard yesterday when I told you that one of the things you could do to improve your blood fluidity was, number 8, get adequate sleep every night. Some obviously were so convicted by just mentioning that point that they decided to take a nap after lunch, and they're not with us yet. But let's talk about sleep and blood fluidity. This was a fascinating study published in the Archives of Internal Medicine some 8 years ago. They actually looked at 30 healthy volunteers. What they did is they observed them when they got 8 hours of sleep per night and compared them when they cut their sleep short down to 4 hours a night. You see what's being looked at. The same subjects are being studied. There's what we call a washout period, if you were worried. That means they gave them some break between these two situations. So 3 to 7 a.m., 4 hours of sleep versus 8 hours of sleep from 11 to 7. Now, I know some of you wish they had studied from 9 to 5 or some other 8 hour sleep interval, but this was what was studied. And they looked at what happened to inflammatory compounds in the body of these healthy individuals. Look at what happened. It's actually quite remarkable. Now, I know that interleukin-6 and tumor necrosis factor alpha are not necessarily household words. But let me make this as simple as I can for you. These two compounds are very important in inflammation in the body. In fact, some of the most potent drugs we have today to address anti-inflammatory or to address inflammatory conditions, things like rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or inflammatory bowel disease, they involve intervening or interfering with these compounds. So look what happens when you cut yourself short on sleep. Your interleukin-6 levels over triple. And your tumor necrosis factor levels over double. Now, if you're still having trouble connecting the dots, it's because we've been going over this kind of quickly, even though we've been trying to take our time, at least I've been trying to do that. What I've been trying to help you see is that anything that worsens inflammation in your body worsens blood fluidity. So if you cut yourself short on sleep, a number of things happen. Here we're seeing a few of them, and that is your inflammatory compounds rise, worsening your blood fluidity. You know what else happens when you cut yourself short on sleep? Your stress hormone levels rise. That's how you keep going. Some of you can just ramp up those stress hormones without thinking about it. And you cut yourself short on sleep, and you say, you know, I don't need much sleep anyway. I only got 3 hours sleep last night, and I feel like $1 million today. Well, I probably shouldn't tell you this, but I used to think I had this great talent, and I needed very little sleep. That's why I could accomplish so much. I really didn't have to sleep much. But truth be told, something interesting would happen in my devotional life. When I'm doing so great with my, you know, 4 hours of sleep or whatever it was, what do you think would happen in my reflective times? I would fall asleep. I told you the other day that I came to the realization that I was sleep deprived when I realized my sleep latency was almost non-existent. That meant when I went lay down, I fell right to sleep. I was sleep deprived, but my body was just ramping up those stress hormones. And just incidentally, I had a lot more, even though this was many years ago, I had a lot more joint problems on that program, even than I do now. So, interesting, huh? Since we're speaking about inflammation and how this can interfere with our optimal blood fluidity, and since we're focused on brain health, we have to talk about vitamin B12. Some of you have been asking me questions about it, but let's talk a little bit about it. First, why the connection at this point? There is some evidence that vitamin B12 deficiency will worsen inflammation in the body. That's why I put this part of the talk in at this point. But this is not the main concern with vitamin B12. Let me tell you about a friend of mine. One of the things that she's done over the years is worked as a hospitalist. So she's an internal medicine specialist who has worked just taking care of patients in the hospital. And we were talking one day about vitamin B12. And she said, you know, I've seen a couple of patients recently with profound dementia. And she said, and no one had checked their B12 level. She ordered B12 levels. Now, I've never seen a B12 level this low. But in both of these individuals, what do you think their B12 level was? It was undetectable. It was undetectable. By the way, once things are that far advanced, they're not reversible. Okay? So here are two people with profound dementia who will never regain their mental faculties because of B12 deficiency. They say, Dr. DeRose, you've convinced me. I'm going right out after this, and I'm going to eat a pound of cheese, and I'm going back to meat because I heard B12 is there. Well, before you get too excited about eating all those animal products, do any of you know, if you look at absolute numbers of people affected with B12 deficiency, and there are lots of them, thousands upon thousands in America, perhaps as many as 1 in 5, 1 in 10 people by the time they get into their 80s have B12 deficiency. It's actually very prevalent. So you look at all these people with B12 deficiency, what is the diet of the majority of them? How would you describe their diet? They're omnivores. They're eating meat. They're eating milk. They're eating eggs. Here's the reason why. The main cause of vitamin B12 deficiency in the population is not inadequate intake. That's right. It's malabsorption or inability to absorb the B12 adequately. B12 has the most complex absorption of any vitamin. It involves factors in the mouth. It involves something called intrinsic factor made by the stomach. And the vitamin B12 is not absorbed till the very end of the small intestine. So anything that goes wrong in any of those levels, and many people over time, because their stomach is not healthy or they get infections with germs like Helicobacter pylori that we've mentioned, maybe you'll have more questions about that in our question and answer time. But that germ can kill the cells in the stomach that make intrinsic factor. There's all kinds of people with vitamin B12 deficiency who are eating plenty of meat, milk, eggs, and cheese. So the solution to vitamin B12 problems is twofold. It is true, vegetarian sources are not necessarily reliable sources of B12, although there's supplemented soy milks and other supplemented foods. I do recommend if you're on a total vegetarian diet, even if you're a lacto-ovo vegetarian, that you take a B12 supplement, and that periodically you actually have your vitamin B12 level checked. Just make sure that things are reasonably well, because it can cause serious, irreversible, not only brain problems, but other nerve problems. So coordination problems, energy level. We call it dysesthesia, normal sensation, abnormal sensation. I had a patient a while back who was having these abnormal sensations and numbness in parts of his face. We said, well, we should check your B12 level. He was very low in vitamin B12. Within a few weeks of getting B12 shots, those symptoms had gone away. So early on, these symptoms are reversible, but then they can become irreversible. So make sure you're getting adequate vitamin B12. Well, if some of you ate lunch and did not brush your teeth, try to do better tomorrow. Okay? because oral health is involved with your blood fluidity. A lot of research on this, just a few studies for you here, a few references. Basically, if there's disease in your gums, if your gums are not healthy, then your blood fluidity will be impaired. Inflammation increases in the body, and blood fluidity, or hemorheology, worsens. In fact, as this points out here, gum disease is specifically linked to higher levels of a number of blood markers that look at blood fluidity. One of them is fibrinogen. Those of you that have been here for the whole hemorheology series, you've probably been dreaming about fibrinogen, haven't you? This clotting protein. The higher the fibrinogen level, the worse the blood fluidity, and your fibrinogen level will go up with poor oral health. Now, you might be surprised that as a physician, I would pay much note to oral health, but I always, when I'm doing a full physical exam, look in people's mouths, and I'm surprised by how poor many people's oral health is. And a lot of my patients say, well, I don't really like the dentist, Dr. DeRose. Well, if you don't like the dentist, you may end up liking the heart surgeon or the neurologist caring for your stroke. You say, Dr. DeRose, you're taking quite a bit of poetic license with that analogy. It's true, but you understand what I'm saying. You're worsening your blood fluidity and increasing your risk of a host of problems. Well, the tenth thing we want to talk about is controlling stress. And I think it's especially appropriate to talk about that now because I've been making you feel bad that you've not been brushing your teeth, that you haven't been exercising, that you're maybe carrying some extra weight. Now I'm going to tell you that I've got you all stressed out. This is bad for your blood fluidity as well. Isn't that reassuring? Well, the good news is, of course, we can manage stress. But let's just give you an idea of some of the research on stress and blood fluidity. I thought this was an interesting study and worth our attention. It's an older study. In this particular study, they invoked or they caused emotional stress by doing what? Showing a video. Isn't this interesting? Are you aware of most of what Americans watch, whether it's DVD or internet or television or movie theater, do you realize most of these things are stress-inducing? Now, someone says, well, I only watch athletics, Dr. DeRose. Very interesting. Maybe I should tell you a little bit about this. There's a certain measure of relaxation that goes with anything that captivates your mind, especially if you have a lot of difficult things that are going on in your life. Do you understand what I'm talking about? We talked a little bit about this with smoking. It's a similar analogy. If you're going through some difficult times and you like to watch sports, you may watch the sporting event and you may feel it was a break from thinking about the fact that you just lost your job and they're, you know, going to kick you out of your home tomorrow morning and things like that. But the actual viewing of the sporting event tends to be stress-inducing. Your stress hormones typically go up in most viewing fare. And this is true of other things besides sports. So interesting, isn't it? What happened when they looked at these people? They found that their blood and plasma viscosity, this is again a measure of blood fluidity, got worse after the stress-inducing video. And they found that part of what seemed to explain it was the rise in these stress hormones that we call catecholamine. By the way, who remembers one of the things that caffeine does for you? What does it raise? It actually raises these catecholamines, these same compounds. So as we talked about caffeine and its problems, some similar things with just stress in general. So what about it? Are you getting some insights here at camp meeting into stress management? Really, some of the most powerful stress management strategies are spiritual. And I think we've been getting a lot of spiritual food at this camp meeting. I know we can't go to every presentation, but I've been to a number that have been very spiritually enriching. And this is actually very powerful when it comes to stress management. Okay, I told you we'd look at 10 things that help hemorheology. We're going to give you a bonus, just because some of you came early. Those of you that came late, you're resting on the laurels of those who were here on time. So we're going to give you this bonus. And that is, don't neglect the conventional cardiovascular risk factors. So we've been talking a lot about lifestyle and diet and exercise and vitamin D, drinking more water. But just because we've been talking about all those things doesn't mean, well, I'm so glad I came to camp meeting. Now, even though I have diabetes, I can throw away my blood sugar monitor. And even though I had high blood pressure, I can just dump that blood pressure monitor. No, you still need to be concerned with all the conventional risk factors as well. I don't think we'll talk about this. If you do want the handouts, these things are in there. So again, if you want the handouts for the material, I'm going to try to be on top of all that. Since we've finished this hemorheology segment, I'll try to make sure those go out this evening. So Dr. DeRose at compasshealth.net. And for those of you that several of you have been talking about radio, by the way, I was happy to meet someone today on the camp meeting grounds, and their contact with the Adventist Church, they traced actually to Life Talk Radio. So I know a number of the churches here are sponsoring radio outreach. One of the stations, one of the Adventist stations that carries our show, has had over 300 baptisms linked to the radio. They have a very strong station out in the Carolinas, and I'm not saying it's because they air my particular show. I'm just saying what they do is they air a lot of Seventh-day Adventist programming. They air health programming as well as spiritual programming, and people listen to radio. And if you're praying about ministry, and sometimes they have these windows of opportunity where you can get a station, think seriously about that. We have a number of Adventist networks. Life Talk is one of them. Some of you know 3ABN has a radio network. So does Radio 74. That's another Adventist network. I think someone here was telling me about a Radio 74 station in Minnesota. So if you're interested, they all have websites. Native Voice One is an exclusively Native American network. It's a secular network that's part of NPR's family of stations, and they also carry our show, American Indian Living. And both of those two networks actually archive the shows as well. So I know some of you felt bad that we ran out of some of the free CDs of the radio show, but you can get the MP3 files right on those websites. Okay, a number of you have been still asking me about what DVDs go along with this series on the brain health revolution. Well, we just finished going through the Methuselah Factor or Longevity Plus. So that's 2 hours on this DVD. So there's one DVD with 2 hours. This is in the ABC. And this, I told you we had some technical problems with it, so this was not professionally reproduced. We just brought 25 of these, and I think last I checked they sold 23 of them. So if you really wanted to get this, this is what we're going to cover next, this material. There's still a few of those left in the Adventist Book Center, at least when I last checked a few hours ago. So sorry we didn't bring more of those, but if you want some of the DVDs from the series, make sure you get them sooner rather than later, because some people who haven't been coming may want to pick them up too. And if you don't get the DVDs, you can get all the PowerPoints for nothing. The DVDs show the PowerPoints and they show me talking. Some of you have heard me talking enough. And in fact, they're recording all this. Bob, they can get the recordings, the audio, for free, right? No? Okay, so later on the conference website, you can hear the audio and you can get the PowerPoints. Now, that works good for self-study. But if you want to show up for your community, remember what I've been encouraging you to do. If you do health events in your church, have some kind of follow-up. Have a monthly health support group. And you can show, if you like my DVDs, you can show my DVDs. If you don't like them, get things from the Minnesota Conference or Dr. Nedley or Dr. Deal. There's all kinds of resources out there that are being produced by the Adventist Church and health professionals within our church. Okay, we're going to switch over to our second topic in our Brain Health series. And just take me a moment to navigate over there. Here we are. This is actually the title series, The Brain Health Revolution. There really is a revolution going on in brain science and lifestyle, things that can make a difference in our optimal mental health. Let's give you a little bit of background. This is recent data from our Centers for Disease Control, more formally known, if I didn't say that right, as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They published results of a study involving some 60,000 Americans across the U.S. This is what we call a representative sample of the population. All of these individuals were 60 years of age or older. And they were looking to try to assess the prevalence of dementia and other memory deficits. Okay, so trying to see what percentage of our population over 60 is struggling with issues like that. Look at this. 12.7% reported increased confusion or memory loss in the preceding 12 months. Well, the good news is twofold. First of all, if you've been experiencing this in the last year, you're not alone. Okay, so you're in good company. But the other bit of good news is this material is something that's relevant to your community. Now, when I looked at that data, I first said, well, individuals over 60. I mean, that includes individuals over 90 and individuals over 100, right? They are all over 60. Maybe the percentage is so high because it's mostly a reflection of people in their 80s and 90s. Actually, it's not the case. Percentage is just about the same if you limited the evaluation, the analysis, to those 60 to 75 or even just 60 to 64 years of age. So the issue is huge problems with memory loss, confusion, and other things that could be the heralds, could be, not necessarily, of a dementing process. At least they're showing some memory impairment and some need for improvement in mental processes. Well, last year I was invited to speak for the Adventist Church in Portugal. They were interested in this topic as well. So I said, well, I need to get some data specific to Portugal. And they've looked at their population. And what do you think they found? Just about the same thing. I won't go into what they looked at specifically. But again, looking at cognitive impairment, again, in a similar population, about 17% in rural dwellers and 12% in urban dwellers. Now, I know those of you living in the country are starting to get worried, but first of all, you're not living in Portugal, so you're supposed to relax a little bit. But the other potential explanation for this is that in many places, many countries, people living in urban areas tend to be more educated and of higher socioeconomic status. And the more education you have, the more we know that the less risk you have of dementia. Are you aware of that? So some of you are feeling bad right now because you don't have any degrees. No, you're supposed to feel good because you're in this class. You see, you're getting ready, you're here at camp meeting. No, really, seriously. Anything that challenges your mind is beneficial. So yeah, it might be great to go back to school. I've had students in my classes I've taught in both secular and Adventist college settings, and I've had students in their 70s. I don't think I've had any in their 80s, but it's not too late. I know some of you might say, well, I'm 90, Dr. DeRose, but I think the oldest graduate in the U.S., I think, was in her 90s. I think I heard that somewhere recently. I forget the exact age. So the point is, yes, there are differences based on education, but the figures are very similar. I didn't do a world comparison, but the point is we're seeing numbers like this in many places in the world. So we want to look in this series at some major cognitive concerns. What kind of things can help you optimize your brain performance? So we're going to first talk a little bit about some mental health issues. Then we're going to talk about neurodegenerative diseases. And then we're going to talk about other lifestyle issues. So that's where we'll go in the remainder of today's presentation and then into tomorrow and Friday. We'll be looking at these various issues. So let's talk about mental health issues first of all. Well, if we talk about mental health and problems with mental processing, we have to talk about depression. Depression is a worldwide epidemic. Some 350 million people, and that's a conservative number, affected worldwide with depression. I mean, that is just a lot of people. Nearly 1 million suicides each year, nearly 20 million suicides. This is worldwide data as a result of depression. And for those of you that are ladies, you may have had this experience. If you gave birth to a child, 10 to 20% of women with postpartum depression. By the way, in your ministry, in your church, this is something to keep mindful of. It often slips under the radar screen because we typically view childbirth as what? A happy thing. But if you had someone who just had a child in your church, you say, well, they're not coming back to church because, you know, they're taking care of the infant. Well, I mean, that's true for a while. But you need to be especially vigilant because sometimes even the family doesn't recognize that the woman is dealing with postpartum depression. Well, roughly 7% of the U.S. population each year has a major depressive disorder. You can see here, often starting relatively early in life, even in the adolescent age range, teenage range, we see that many individuals, 3% may not sound like a lot, but if you do the math, this is a lot of people. And if you think about it, if you've got a school or a church school with 30 students, I mean, that's one out of the 30 students that's statistically likely to have a serious debilitating depressive disorder. We're not just talking about a little mild depression. We don't want to minimize that either. Back in 1995, there was a question in the medical community, and that is, can depression alone affect cognitive performance? And you may say, well, of course it can. But, you know, we don't want to just jump to conclusions in the research community. You really want to make sure that you can connect the dots, and it's for real. And so back in 1995, they did what they call a meta-analysis. They pooled all the data, looking at cognitive performance and memory, and here's what they concluded. There is a significant, stable association between depression and memory impairment. And what that simply means is consistently, as you look study after study, if you're depressed, your memory, your cognition is not going to function as well. Someone was telling me not all that long ago about someone they knew who was actually a coworker. And this coworker was not very responsible, was not doing a good job. They didn't seem to be very sharp. What do you think turned out to be the person's problem? They were depressed. And once they got their depression treated, they became an excellent and model employee. What is the cornerstone of depression therapy? You go to the average physician, what would they tell you? Okay, pills, medication. But here we're going to say it's what? It's lifestyle. Lifestyle is really very powerful when it comes to depression. How many of you have actually gone through or have seen Dr. Nedley's depression recovery program? Okay, so a few of you, not the majority. But that's really an excellent program. And I just want to show you, just kind of give you an overview. If you want to do some work in your community with depression, Dr. Nedley, his team will certify people. Now, I'll just tell you, I was thinking about this, and you could do it, theoretically, if you wanted, as you're having this big evangelism push in the Twin Cities next year, you could theoretically do multiple sites doing a depression recovery program. You could have multiple churches offering these, And I don't get any referral fee from Dr. Nedley for talking about his program. But it's a very good program, and for those of you that have used it, it has a very strong spiritual connection. There's a Bible component in it, but it's not so heavy that it alienates people who are not Christians. I've used the program with many people. And he makes a specific appeal as the program is winding down for people to continue to study the Bible, especially studying Bible prophecy, because of the abstract nature of Bible prophecy. So it really actually sets the stage for an evangelistic meeting that features Bible prophecy. So I know when I was pastoring, this was very effective. We'd do a depression recovery program, and then we'd invite those people to the evangelistic meetings, and we'd see those people attend. So not all of them, of course. I'll just tell you one interesting thing the Lord did since we're speaking about this. We did a depression recovery seminar, and it was in an Adventist school in Maine, and then we were holding the evangelistic series afterward in an Adventist church. And whenever you try to, move people from one venue to another, you tend to lose some people. And one of the interesting things the Lord orchestrated was a follow-up group for the depression recovery program. Where do you think we ended up having that follow-up group? Yeah, we had it in the basement of the church. And so the depression recovery program finished, and maybe a week later the evangelistic meeting started. We invited people to the evangelistic meeting. Some of them came, but others didn't. And so, like most evangelistic series, we started on a weekend. And come, I think it was Tuesday, we're having a support group for the depression recovery program. And it's in the basement of the church. So people from the community came to the church to go to the depression recovery program. Some of them had not been to the evangelistic meetings that perhaps unbeknownst to them were going to start right after their support group finished. And we had a Bible worker who was leading out with the support group, but he had me speak, talk for the support group. And then I said, well, I'm giving a health talk before this other meeting we're having up in the church after you finish, and you're welcome to come up and join us for that too. So some of the people who hadn't been to the evangelistic meetings, they came up to hear the health talk. I told them they could leave right after the health talk. What do you think? You think anyone left right after the health talk? Actually, they did. Some of them did leave right after the health talk. They didn't want to hear the Bible meeting. But some of them who hadn't come to the evangelistic meetings, they stayed for the meeting. So what I'm just saying, I'm just trying to help you catch this vision. I'm not saying the depression recovery program is magic, but the more things you do that reach out to your community, and if you're praying about ways for God to connect those dots, there'll be people that you come into close contact with and they'll be studying the Bible with you and will end up being members of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and some of them love Jesus already. But others will be introduced to Jesus for the first time, whether they join the Adventist church or not. So I'm just trying to expand your vision as far as the power of health ministry. So let's look at what's included in Dr. Nedley's program and the kind of things that I recommend to patients with depression issues. By the way, these principles help you even if you're not depressed as far as mental performance. We do recommend a vegan diet. But we're going to talk about this in some detail in our remaining time together on brain health. We probably won't get to this subject today, but omega-3 fats. We'll be talking about these healthy fats. Regular physical exercise. Have you heard about that before? Healthy beverages like water. Judicious sunshine. Sunshine is not only important for vitamin D, bright light itself has mood-elevating effects. So some of you are wondering why we have the lights dimmed in here, right? If bright light. By the way, the light inside lights are not bright enough to have optimal mood-elevating benefits. You need to get outside. And if it's not, the weather's not conducive, it's thundering and lightning, and you're susceptible to low light levels as far as lowering your mood, you may want to get a light box that gives you that kind of bright light. It's the level of intensity of light that you have just before the sun comes up in the morning, just before dawn. That's about 10,000 lux. That's a unit, a measure of brightness. Well, let's look at four other things that we talk about when we're trying to improve mental health, especially in the area of depression. Avoiding all neurotoxins. These are substances that are toxic to the nerves, alcohol, tobacco, and caffeine. Deep breathing and fresh air actually have mood-elevating benefits. Getting adequate rest. And then high-quality reading, music, and activities also have mood-elevating properties. So this is kind of an overview. And if you're interested, I wouldn't be surprised if the ABC has some copies of Dr. Nedley's book. His website, drnedley.com, has his books, his videos, and other things. Okay, let's move on to talk about neurodegenerative diseases. How many of you actually know that scientists have discovered a powerful weapon against some of the most feared neurodegenerative conditions, like Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's? Are you aware of this? Since we're talking about depression, this compound actually can help with normal brain functioning, and it can help prevent depression. It's something that I referred to briefly the other day, and that's something called brain-derived neurotrophic factor. If you know anything about medical terminology, you already know a lot about what BDNF is. Brain-derived. That means the compound is actually made by the brain. What is neuro referred to? Nerves, or brain cells and nerve cells, that's neuro. Do I even know what trophic refers to? It actually refers to growth. So this is literally a nerve growth factor that's made by your own brain. Well, what does it do for you? Like I said, it can improve cognitive function. If you have an addictive problem or an addictive personality, it actually may help with a variety of addictions, a lot of research on alcohol. It actually has appetite suppressant effects. So if you tend to be a compulsive overeater, if you could boost levels of BDNF in your brain, that would help you. Well, as I mentioned, it helps with a variety of diseases. We mentioned Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Also can help prevent ischemic stroke. And we'll talk about that just for a minute. There's two main types of stroke. There's what we call a bleeding stroke or a hemorrhagic stroke. And then there's an ischemic stroke. Sometimes it's also called a thrombotic stroke. Probably pretty obvious what a hemorrhagic stroke is. That's when a blood vessel ruptures and you get bleeding into the brain. Well, what then is a thrombotic or ischemic stroke? That's right. That's where a clot blocks a blood vessel supplying the brain. And BDNF has been shown higher levels help to decrease your risk of thrombotic stroke. Does not seem to affect your risk of bleeding stroke. That's largely related to high blood pressure and to congenital weakness in blood vessels. Well, what do you think? Have drug companies come up with a BDNF pill? What do you think? Oh, I'm sure they would love to, but the problem is BDNF has to be in the brain. And I'm sure the drug companies are working to find something that when you take it orally, it will boost levels of BDNF in your brain. But so far, I've not seen any evidence that they've had any success in this field yet. But we're going to look at how lifestyle can help boost levels of BDNF. Wouldn't that be good? And let's see what we can do to improve levels of this compound. How do we naturally boost BDNF? Well, the first one is dietary restriction. We're going to talk about that in a little bit of detail. Next one is regular physical exercise. And then the third one is environmental enrichment or stimulation. Now, some of this may be looking familiar to you, and that's probably good because God has given us a comprehensive lifestyle that's designed to help spare us from many problems. And then there's alcohol avoidance. The research also indicates that alcohol is harmful for the balance of neurotrophins in the brain because there's a variety of nerve growth factors, not just BDNF. Let me give you a disclaimer as we get into this. We've talked about this concept already. Let's say someone in your church has Parkinson's disease or maybe Alzheimer's. What might we be tempted to do after hearing a lecture like this? Well, I wonder what they weren't doing. Maybe they were overeating. Maybe they weren't exercising enough. Perhaps they weren't getting enough environmental stimulation. Is that possible? Our minds could go on that channel? It's possible, but the point is simply this. Even if you're following an excellent lifestyle, doesn't mean you couldn't have one of these disorders, okay? So we can never judge anyone else or their lifestyle based on what conditions they have. We should try to help them with whatever they're dealing with. But interestingly, if you're genetically predisposed to disease, what the evidence clearly indicates is that the healthier your lifestyle, the greater the latency period between the development of the disease, or latency period of time before the disease develops, most simply. Let me explain it to you this way. How many of you have ever had to make a difficult decision about repairing a car? Some of you might have an older vehicle. How do you know when the vehicle has reached its useful lifespan? You know, should you do that transmission job, or are you going to fix the transmission and then, you know, the engine's going to have to be overhauled, and, you know, the electrical system doesn't seem to be working that good. How do you know when to just dump that old car? When it's not worth it, but how do you know? How about your body? If your body was a car, and let's say you could go online, and you could find out, you know, now that they'll do genetic testing, you can have individual genetic testing, but let's say they go a step beyond that, and they can tell you exactly what diseases you'll get during your lifespan. Now, if it was your car, you'd go to the used car lot, and the guy there could say, well, this car, I can guarantee you, if you buy it, it's going to have, you know, trouble with the exhaust system, and the engine's going to need to be overhauled. And you could see the whole list with every car. But if there was such a list, but you could choose when in the life of the car or when in the life of your body those conditions would occur, what would you choose? How many of you would say, well, look, if I know I'm going to get diabetes, heart disease, cancer, I'm going to go blind, have kidney failure, I mean, that'd be a lot to come on me at once. So probably when I'm in my 20s, I'd like to have a heart attack. In my 30s, I'd have the cancer. When I'm 40, maybe go blind. And that's hard to lose vision, but a lot of people, you know, really do well. And many very productive people who, you know, have visual challenges. So I think I could handle it. Would you do that, or would you say, you know what? I think I'll schedule all these things to come knocking on my door the week before I die. How many of you, does that sound like the better option? What I'm trying to explain to you is actually a preventive medicine concept called compression of morbidity. It's actually a concept in the public health and preventive medicine field called compression of morbidity. Morbidity is pain and suffering. So the idea is, if we can do things, we may never, maybe you're genetically prone to Alzheimer's. We may never be able to prevent Alzheimer's in your case. But if we could postpone it to the week before you die, I mean, that's not too bad, is it? Could you handle Alzheimer's for a week? Well, you prefer not to. You prefer to have all you prefer to die like Moses, right, at 120 with all your faculties intact, right? You wouldn't know. Yeah, you would. Yeah, if it was profound Alzheimer's, it just came on instantaneously. Yeah, you wouldn't know the difference. But the point I'm making is, when it comes to lifestyle, we may not be able to prevent everything, but we can compress the morbidity. No, we may not be able to stave things off to the last week of our life. But someone could come down with a disease that's pretty bad in their 50s or their 40s. And they might say, well, why did this happen to me? I was following such a good lifestyle. Well, you may have had that disease condition at 20 if you hadn't been serious about it. Do you understand what I'm saying? So we can't question God as to why these things come. We're living in a world of sin. We've got degraded bodies. By the way, if you haven't heard, one of the more compelling arguments for a very short time of human life on this planet, like around 6,000 years. It's the concept of genetic entropy. Have you heard about this? It's the if you actually look at our genes, and they're degrading at such a rapid rate that some experts are saying there's no way the human race could have been around for hundreds of thousands of years, because we wouldn't be here. Our genetics are degrading so rapidly, it looks like we've only been around for about 6,000 years. Isn't that interesting? So the point is, in this deteriorating, I know it's an interesting aside, but the point is that we live in that kind of a world, and we have those kind of bodies. And so the point is, it's likely that all of us, or most of us, are going to suffer some significant problems. But by God's grace, by cooperating with Him, the evidence is we can increase the disease-free interval. So let's look at these factors that can help us on a mental health level and can help us in other ways as well. Let's start by talking about dietary restriction. By the way, this is one of my favorite topics to speak about. You know, one of the criticisms of people in the natural medicine movement and preventive medicine movement is that they're always trying to sell you something. Some of you might think, I've been trying to sell you my DVDs or whatever. Well, listen, this should put any questions about my motives to rest. Because what do I gain if you start doing better at dietary restriction? If you eat less, what happens? Who makes money when you eat less? Only you do. We're not selling you. I'm not selling you a supplement. We're talking about dietary restriction. Let's look at it. How many of you does this look like a delicious breakfast? No, this is not actually what we're talking about. You do want to eat a good breakfast. And if you come to the cafeteria, I eat considerably more than this at breakfast time. But, no, this is not what we're talking about. By the way, that brings up an interesting aside. I find that some people are like me. They remember some of these stories and illustrations better than some of the scientific data. Some of you are old enough to remember the days when domestic flights in the United States used to serve meals. Do you actually remember that? You wouldn't have to pay for them? I was so impressed with one of the airlines. And fortunately, I don't remember which one it was, even though I could guess. But they somehow had found some of the most talented chefs in the world. Now, this is truly incredible. These chefs could cut tomatoes and cucumbers so thin that you could actually see through them. Okay? And so I would order my vegan meal on the plane. And they'd give me two pieces of whole wheat bread, these micro-thin, maybe a slice or two of tomato and cucumber, and a piece of lettuce. And I can imagine them making these sandwiches, and they're saying, who in the world can survive on a vegetarian diet? Well, I don't want you to have this mindset about dietary restriction. We're not talking about starving you. This is not the picture that I want you to remember for what your breakfast is supposed to look like. I'm showing you this picture to make a point. You don't have to be this restrictive with your diet. Do you understand? But here's what we find. In both animal models and other studies as well, even human studies, the evidence indicates that whether it's decreased caloric intake at each meal or whether it's periodic fasting, these processes improve longevity and they increase levels of BDNF. So cutting back on calories. Why would this work? Is stress good or bad? Is stress good or bad? Someone says both. I have a word that I like better. Did you not figure out which one? Depends. Actually, stress in moderation is good. Do you realize this? Now, many of you don't think mental or emotional stress in moderation is good, but it actually is good. And we could, you know, talk about that biblically, but we won't go into detail about that. But maybe we should. In 2 Corinthians, that book starts out with saying that God comforts us in all our tribulation. And why does it say He does it? One reason. so that we may comfort others with the comfort He gives us. When we go through difficult times, it increases our capacity to minister to others. I think there's a whole seminar. I've been wanting to sneak in on some of the different seminars. I haven't caught that with dealing with chronic illness. Are they talking about some of those things in that seminar? So have you been there? The brain, if it's stressed, actually produces more BDNF. Mild stress helps your brain. And one way to mildly stress your brain is by caloric deficit. In one primate model, to get this effect, this BDNF enhancing effect, you have to cut caloric intake back about 30%. Now, I shared this figure with you earlier, and some of you came to a conclusion you might easily be able to do this by leaving off the evening meal. If you're eating about the same number of calories at each meal, you leave off supper and you just cut your calories back 30%, right? But it's a little bit more complicated than that because it's easy to overeat at any given meal, isn't it? And when we do that, let me tell you, this is really interesting. If you take rodents and you cut their caloric intake back 20%, how much longer will they live? They'll live about 20% longer. You cut their calories back about 30%, how much longer will they live? 30% longer. Now be careful. How about if you cut their calories back 99%? Yeah, they'll die of starvation sooner. But the point is, it's almost as if in this world of sin, our bodies can process so many calories, and then we die. If you look at large, you know, if you look at the research. So the idea shouldn't be, oh, I'm so glad that I can eat so much and not be overweight. I feel so sorry for that person next to me because they have to watch what they eat, and I can just, you know, I can just eat 20 pounds of food. And don't feel jealous either. If you tend to gain weight easier than some other people, don't say, oh, I wish I was like that person. I have to work so hard. You're actually, potentially, doing some very good things for your brain by having to be more consciously cutting back on your calories than someone else who may have other tendencies. So, more good news about eating less. Like I said, it's the most consistent longevity-stimulating factor that's known in the longevity area. So rather than investing in the latest hormones, some of you are asking me about this. What do I think about, you know, these bioidentical hormones? Or, you know, there's this field of longevity medicine, and they even show pictures. I think some of them make it into the medical journals. I don't know how they let these. It couldn't be medical journals. But these, you know, 80-year-old men, you know, who are, you know, just very muscular, and, you know, they're using their, you know, human growth hormone and testosterone and DHEAS, and so they're taking all these hormones and they're just this great physical specimen. Is that what we should all be doing? Let me tell you what's happened, what I've seen happen. All of these hormone replacement strategies, all that we've seen when they're fully played out, they end up being deleterious. And unless you have a specific biological deficiency that any endocrinologist would agree to. Okay? So just saying, well, I want to be more youthful, Dr. DeRose. I'm 95, and the doctor said my, you know, testosterone level is normal for my age, but it's still lower than it was when I was 20. You're asking for trouble to start, you know, getting testosterone shots to try to improve your youthfulness. So it may, you say, it's helping me get more muscle mass, Dr. Girls. Well, if you really are deficient, but don't try to have the hormonal physiology of a 20-year-old when you're 70. It actually doesn't work from what we've seen. And I can't tell you the full answer is in, and there's other people who are just as bright or brighter than I am that have different opinions, but usually if we let nature take its course and cooperate with the Lord, that's safer than trying to be smarter than God and trying to take some of these things in our own hands. And some of you say it's too strong a language, Dr. DeRose. If it is, I apologize. Do you feel better now? Okay. So, dietary restriction incidentally improves blood fluidity, if you were wondering. It decreases inflammation and helps you in a host of ways. So this is actually good news. You can have a seminar in your community how to improve your health and save money. And you can offer it for free in that case. You just tell them, just come in, and in 5 minutes you say, just eat less. We're all done. Now, I wouldn't recommend a seminar like that. We're trying to build rapport with people. Look at this. We talked about some of these factors that get elevated when you cut yourself short on sleep. Isn't this interesting? If you restrict your caloric intake, these inflammatory compounds actually decrease. And this is one of the reasons why fasting is a powerful anti-inflammatory strategy. Okay, final few slides, and I know I was hoping to give you some time for questions and answers. We'll try to leave more of that tomorrow, because sometimes it's hard to, some of you are looking very distressed. Okay, well, we'll stop right now. We'll take your questions. We'll talk about this tomorrow. This is questions relating to this compression of morbidity, some very interesting research on Alzheimer's, and how we potentially could decrease the number of cases by millions if we understand some of these principles of dietary restriction. I'll give you some more pointers on how to restrict your diet as well. We'll talk about that tomorrow. Some of that material is, if you've already seen my DVD on Listening to the Buffalo, it seems like Native Americans understood the difference between hunger and appetite. That's what we'll talk about tomorrow. Let's squeeze in a few questions, because I can see some of you have some burning questions on your mind. Do we have a roving mic somewhere? Roving. Okay. I heard this collective gasp when I said there was no question and answer time. Maybe I'm just hearing things. Did someone have a question that they really wanted to answer? Is someone wondering why the lights are dimmer here than usual? Did it put more of you to sleep? Or do you feel it was good because you were improving your hemorheology? We've got a question back over there.
What is your concept of fasting?
Oh, my concept of fasting? Well, we actually, one of the good things about camp meeting is there's a lot of good things happening, and we can kind of, like I'm doing, kind of slip in and out of different programs. And so I want everyone to know you're always welcome to come to a meeting I'm giving and ask any question you want. Because even if we talked about it like that, and we talked about it some, but it's a good opportunity to review. So don't feel inhibited if you haven't been here to ask questions. Fasting, actually, is a very interesting topic. Who remembers what lecture we talked about that in? Was it in the Methuselah Factor material? Some of you think so. We also talked about it in the Gospel of Mark series. We have material in both. But there's a number of different types of fasts. A fast basically is anything where you actually eat less in a systematic way. That's probably the easiest way to think about it. So you could go on a fast where you just fast. In fact, the Catholics historically would go on a fast from red meat on Friday. Okay? And they would just eat fish. That's a fast. Although they're still, you know, they're still eating. You can go on a fast like our Muslim friends do, you know, in the month of Ramadan, where they don't eat during the daylight hours, right? They eat after the sun goes down. Am I understanding that right? Mm-hmm. Some of you, is that right? So there's different ways of fasting. Ellen White actually has a number of very interesting statements on fasting in the book Counsels on Diet and Foods, around page 189, page 190, where she actually says all of us should practice a certain type of fasting, and that's basically avoiding stimulating and harmful foods. So on a certain level, all of us should avoid harmful things. We should all fast from alcohol, tobacco, caffeine, right? And then when it comes to what we're talking about here, I'm going to go into more detail about how we can cut back on intake. We'll talk about hunger and appetite in more detail. But the general, does that help give you some framework? And that is an excellent question, is because you can have a fast for your church. Your church can fast, and that doesn't mean that every member has to eat zero calories, that they all can only have water. In fact, Ellen White in those very statements speaks about how it may not be necessary for every, you know, it's not necessary for everyone to leave off everything. So some of you can't fast completely for medical reasons, and you can just eat a more simple diet. Okay, was there one other burning question before we wind up? Okay, since your hand went up first, Lee, it looks like you have the most burning question. Is that fair? Did his hand go up before you? Okay.
With regard to depression and vegan diet, why don't we see the same benefit from a lacto-ovo diet? Is it just the vegan diet that provides us with the benefit of lowering our depression?
Okay, so it's a good question. The vegan diet is optimal. We're going to actually talk about this in detail. We're going to talk about tyrosine and tryptophan in this series. Tyrosine and tryptophan, and I don't want to, even one part of the answer is fairly complicated, but let me try to make it as simple as I can just to let you know where we're going. So just like we're going to talk about how to curb appetite in our next presentation, learning how to distinguish between hunger and appetite, this question we'll probably get to on Friday. I don't know that we'll get to it tomorrow. But in order to optimize the delivery of the raw materials that your brain needs to make serotonin, which is a mood-elevating compound, that's tryptophan, that's the raw material to make serotonin, and in order to make other neurotransmitters like dopamine, that's tyrosine, is the raw material, amino acid, protein building block that's needed. Certain things have to be happening in your blood. The more animal products you eat, the more protein you eat, actually, the more difficult it is to get those amino acids into the brain. So that's one partial explanation. We're going to be talking about some other things, the type of fats and other things that are involved, because the animal fats are actually deleterious to brain, to nerve membrane structure. So where the action takes place, we call it the synapse. The saturated fat that you find in animal products makes the nerve membrane stiffer, and so nerve transmission is not as efficient. Those are a few of the answers. We're going to talk more about those things. Well, right now we've kind of run out of time. Can I answer yours individually, or do you think donating blood is a question?
Yeah. I have several family members, when they donate blood, pass out. So you talked about donating blood, and I have O negative blood. Everybody's bothering me all the time to donate. But I'm afraid that I'm going to pass out if I give blood.
Okay.
It's
very important before you donate blood to be well hydrated. So make sure you're well hydrated. And it's also important for some people not to look at the blood coming out of them. No, really. I'm just telling you. And then many people just rapidly changing position, especially with the blood volume being a bit lower, you'll get lightheaded. So what we tell people like that is you're laying down when you donate the blood, then don't even sit up and dangle your legs over. Ask them for some water or some juice or something and drink that while your legs are still elevated on the bed. Then swing your legs over the bed a minute or two later, and then drink, or the cot or whatever they're taking the blood on, and then drink some more water, and then stand up. So give your system more time to equilibrate, because, and especially as we get older, that may take a little bit more time. Okay, we're already over time, so thank you for your patience. Let's pray as we leave. Father in heaven, you're the God of all comfort, as we were speaking about. And sometimes when we speak about health topics, it can seem somewhat uncomfortable. But you only give us discomfort if you're wanting to help heal us. You're like the loving surgeon who only would cut something away if it's not in our best interest to retain it. So please help us to understand your loving ministry in the realm of health and help us communicate that to others. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage you. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.